If you wanted to speak to a lot of people 40 years ago, there were some hurdles. You'd have to come up with the funds to put an ad on the TV or on a billboard. Or you'd need the connections to get a column posted in the newspaper. Today, the internet has made spreading our thoughts and ideas across the world easier than ever. Our next guest says that's had a complicated effect on our democracy, especially in a time of disinformation and misinformation. We're talking about speech, the internet, and how they affect American politics, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see misinformation showing up in your own social media feed? Are you worried about how it spreads, how it affects our politics? Do you hesitate before sharing a story or before believing a story that you see online? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Rick Hassan is the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine. He's co-director of the Fair Elections and Free Speech Center. His latest book is called Cheap Speech: How Disinformation Poisons Our Politics and How to Cure It. Rick, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be back with you.
It's a borrowed phrase. What do you mean by cheap speech?
Right. It is a borrowed phrase. It comes from a law review article that was written in the Yale Law Journal back in 1995 by a professor named Eugene Volokh at UCLA Law School. And he was predicting the upcoming internet social media revolution. He's writing before all of the rise of things like Spotify and Netflix, and thought this was going to be just a mostly good development for American democracy. Getting rid of intermediaries meant you could get information very easily. We'd go from kind of a trickle of information to a flood of information. And he thought that people would do pretty well without having intermediaries like the local newspaper figure out what's worth hearing, what is truth and what is justified. And you know, so he meant cheap speech, that it's inexpensive. In my book, Cheap Speech, written now in 2022, I see a dark side to this. It's very expensive to produce quality journalism. The economic market for producing newspapers has changed. Journalists have lost jobs faster than coal miners because classified advertising and other kinds of advertising, just you don't need to use newspapers for that anymore. Still very expensive to produce quality information, but very cheap to produce fake information. And so we have kind of a problem with the marketplace of ideas in that the disinformation crowds out the true information. Voters throw up their hands. They don't want to pay for the true information. Some voters even have developed a taste for disinformation when it confirms what they really believe. So it really is, as you said at the top, a complicated relationship with our democracy and information.
You opened the book with a case study, pretty well known now. You had worried that then President Trump wouldn't accept an election loss. You were worried about this way before the 2020 election. He lost the election. And yet here we are still in 2022 with former President Trump and others still contesting the election loss. Can you talk about the flow of that misinformation and how it fits into your concept of cheap speech?
Sure. So one of the claims I make in the book is that if we had the same polarized politics of today, but the technology of the 1950s, we wouldn't be in the same democracy mess that we are in right now. So if you think about the fact that millions of people now believe the false claim that the 2020 election was stolen, and I've studied the election very carefully, and I've been studying elections for a very long time, I don't believe there's any reliable evidence that the 2020 election was stolen. But Donald Trump was able to go, just looking at his Twitter feed, over 400 times between November 3rd and November 21st to make false and exaggerated and vitriolic claims about the election being stolen. I think he inspired the events of January 6th by directly going to voters, telling them to stop the steal and to come to DC for a wild time. People organized on Facebook groups, we know this, to participate in some of it illegal actions. If we were back in the technology of the 1950s, the local newspaper, the local radio station, the New York Times would not be 400 times repeating Trump's false claims and giving them amplification. It is a kind of information environment where demagogues can flourish and where misinformation, especially when it makes people feel better about their situation, whether that's economically or politically, there's a demand for it. So there's a supply that is supplied for political reasons and sometimes for financial reasons. A lot of people have gotten rich off the Stop the Steal movement, and the supply fuels more demand for ever more outlandish explanations for how we got into the predicament we're in today.
Talking to Rick Hassan about his new book, Cheap Speech, How Disinformation Poisons Our Politics and How to Cure It. You can join in at 800-642-1234. One consequence, Rick, of a lot of misinformation is people might believe it. You point toward another consequence, though. I'm going to quote here from your book. Bad information is driving out good, and voters discount all information as potentially unreliable, end quote. So it might be persuading some people to believe things that aren't true. It might persuade other people, misinformation, to just give up.
Sure. And, let me give an example of this. About maybe 2 weeks ago, the Washington Post ran a story about an upcoming documentary about Roger Stone. Roger Stone, one of the kind of President Trump's allies, a longtime political dirty trickster, who's recorded on video doing some things that indicate he had far more involvement in the events of January 6th than he has led on to. And after this story broke, Roger Stone said, no, these were deep fakes. These were false videos making me look bad. And there's no reason to believe that these were fake videos, but yet in an environment where there's so much fake information floating out there, you have what Professors Chesney and Citrin have called the liar's dividend. It's easier to claim true information is false, to claim everything is fake news. Trump liked to call all bad news against him fake news. And you're right, voters sometimes will just throw up their hands and say, I can't trust anything. And then that's not good for democracy, because we want voters to be able to get reliable information so they can make voting choices consistent with their values and their interests.
Before we go to our callers, Rick, you spend most of your book looking at possible solutions. I want to touch on a little bit of that here. You look at potential, first of all, legal changes related to misinformation. You dismiss some of them as being potential violations of our free speech. As you sort through possible legal remedies, what stand out to you as the most promising avenues?
Well, so let's start off by saying that we should have a commitment both to a democracy where voters can get reliable information to make those sensible decisions, but also one that's committed to free speech, which is protected by the First Amendment. And you know, any democracy needs to have lots of breathing room for people to say things that might be controversial so voters can make their choices. You know, how do you balance these things? And so some people think, hearing me talk about the problems of cheap speech, that I'm calling for censorship. And really, I'm not. I don't think, other than some very narrow areas like foreign spending, or when people lie about when election day is, or if you can vote by text, and we've had examples of that, I don't favor limiting speech. What I favor is other kinds of laws that help to make better decisions. So, for example, talked about those deep fakes. These are these audios or videos that can be use artificial intelligence to make it look like a politician is doing something embarrassing or having some kind of health crisis. I want all of those videos labeled as altered. That way, a voter will know, is this something that I can believe? Can I believe my own eyes? Can I believe my own ears? And so labeling or disclosure is a way to deal with the problem that that people don't necessarily know what's true. And we had a situation in 2016 where the Russian government was using agents to pose as African-American voters and say, don't vote for Hillary Clinton, don't show up to vote at all. I think those voters would have liked to know that those were not actually African-American voters who were making these claims, but Russian government workers. So we need improved disclosure laws when it comes to attempts to influence our elections. That's the kind of thing I think we need. It's not going to solve all our problems. Law is only a partial solution, but I think it is an important part of the package of what we need.
Talking to Rick Hassan, co-director of the Fair Elections and Free Speech Center at the University of California, Irvine. He's with us today to talk about his latest book, Cheap Speech, How Disinformation Poisons Our Politics and How to Cure It. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see more local news produced in your community? Do you miss a local newspaper? Do you see people in your network sharing misinformation? Did you see that during the 2020 election, say? Do you think Facebook, Twitter, other social media providers should be more aggressive about limiting misinformation. If so, how? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with election law expert Rick Hassan about his latest book, Cheap Speech, How Disinformation Poisons Our Politics and How to Cure It. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, gentlemen. Great topic. I wanted to tell you, when I was a teenager, I was a paper boy. I used to deliver the Superior Evening Telegram. It was a daily. And when Nixon resigned and the Fitzgerald sank, I had people coming up to me on my bike, buying my paper for a dollar. Just give me a copy, you know? And as I got older, I continued with the assumption that people wanted to know the news. But I'm 60 years old now, and I don't think people really want to know. In fact, I think one of the cool things about fake news and misinformation is it's kind of entertaining. Like, who would say something crazy like what we've heard? So to the point now where I don't even have a TV, I don't watch the news, and, you know, I just live my life, and everything seems to be fine.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Rick, do we want to know the news? Can we handle the news?
Well, I think it's interesting that the person called and said they're not listening to the news, but they're obviously listening to your program or they wouldn't be calling in. I mean, I think people still get the news. I think there is a small subset of society that is not going to be swayed by listening to the news, but there's a much larger part of society that is looking for truthful and reliable information, even if they get it incidentally, even if they see, you know, a headline as they're walking down the street and see a newspaper, or they're turning the dial, or they're watching a sports program and they get a headline. So I think, you know, there's a lot of fatigue out there now, given the polarization of our politics, especially in a place like Wisconsin, where things have gotten so ugly. I think there's a tendency to want to withdraw. But we really do, as a democracy, need to have engaged citizens, and engaged citizens who can tell truth from falsity. And that's the kind of thing that I'm concerned about in the book.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. We'll go next to Jay on the line in Madison. Jay, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Jay?
I just wanted to ask Rick, kind of about the difference between newspaper and television media. I know that, like, newspapers have op-ed sections where it's very clearly distinguished when opinions are being presented versus just news and factual information. I think a lot of the frustration with television media is it seems like 90% of it is opinion pieces anymore. And a lot of people, I've heard conservatives and liberals will talk about the good old days when the news was just the news.
Jay, thanks. Blurry lines on TV news in particular, Rick, where people don't know if they're getting a news or an opinion bit.
Right. Well, you know, so the issue today is that there is just a flood of information, and good information and bad information, fact and opinion. It's the same thing if you go onto Facebook or Twitter. Some things are going to be true, some things are going to be false, some things are going to be opinion. So this does raise the, you know, what I talk about in the last part of the book, the kind of non-law related ways of trying to deal with this. And one of those is digital literacy, figuring out how you can give people the tools to be able to tell the difference between news and opinion. And I think it's very important for stations like MSNBC or Fox or CNN to make it very clear when something is news and when it is opinion. And, you know, right now we know that CNN is going to have a new owner, and the talk is that the all the opinion shows that appear in the evening, there's going to be more of a pushback towards straight news. One of the reasons that we don't see straight news in the evenings on any of these programs is because opinion is what sells. People want to hear what is going to reinforce their existing beliefs. So it might be that the economic incentive is to produce opinion rather than news, and that's unfortunate.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Rick Hassan about his new book, Cheap Speech, How Disinformation Poisons Our Politics and How to Cure It. Before we go back to our callers, Rick, I wanted to talk about, you mentioned non-legal ways to tackle the problem. You are looking to the Facebooks and Twitters of the world, the social media platforms, to make some changes, and maybe for the public to put pressure on them to make those changes. What kind of things would be most useful, do you think?
Well, so let's start off by pointing out that Facebook and Twitter, just like Fox News or the New York Times are private entities, so they're not subject to the First Amendment the way the government is, right? So Facebook all the time decides not to include speech. It says, you know what, we're not going to publish hate speech. We're not going to publish pornography. If they didn't do that, these platforms would be much less pleasant and people wouldn't use them. But a government couldn't do that. A government couldn't say, you know, no hateful speech, right? So if they are private entities, how should we deal with them? They are very powerful. I do think that public pressure, for example, on whether or not to deplatform a candidate, that's a decision that the platform should make. But if people don't like the inclusion or the exclusion of Donald Trump, they should make their views known about that issue. Somewhat troublingly, Justice Clarence Thomas of the United States Supreme Court suggested an opinion last year that he thinks it would be constitutional to have a law that forces social media companies to carry the speech of politicians that they don't want to carry, even someone who might falsely claim that elections are being stolen or who might advocate for political violence. And I think that's not the way to go. I think these should be voluntary decisions. I don't think a state should have the availability to something like Facebook or Twitter, a social media company, to carry speech than they could force Fox News or the New York Times to carry such speech. We already have precedents from the Supreme Court that TV stations and newspapers can't be forced to do that.
Let's go back to our callers now. Jim is with us in Dubuque, Iowa. Jim, hi.
Hi. Well, I think we've developed a problem over a few decades where there's been a consolidation of media to the extent that they're controlled by a handful of corporate entities. And that gives them tremendous power to shape the agenda and the information that people are able to, you know, acquire without some other effort. And even especially a big problem nowadays is censorship, where you can declare a factual statement, any factual statement, practically a hate speech.
Jim, thanks for the call. Rick, he's worried, first of all, about too much concentrated control of media, I think including local media. Do you see that as part of the problem?
Well, so to the extent that there is media concentration, I think that the solution to that, whether that's social media or more traditional media, I think the solution to that is antitrust. That is, you know, if we think a search company like Google has too much power and could sway how elections are run, then we need to figure out how to give them less power. We can't have a law that says you must be even-handed, because I really wouldn't trust a government bureaucrat to be able to do that. I mean, think of the president you like the least and imagine that he or she has the ability to just decide what's unfair, right? And so I don't think we'd want that. So the way to deal with problems of media concentration, if they arise, is through breaking up those companies and then letting there be competition. Something like Facebook, it's not a monopoly, but it does have an advantage in that it there are network effects. So you only want to go on Facebook if a lot of your friends are there. You know, there is a question about how you break up Facebook. But one thing I'd point out is that Meta, the company that now owns Facebook, also owns Instagram and WhatsApp. And it's not clear that that's a good model. Think about Google. It's not just search, right? It's advertising and lots of other things. YouTube, for example, owned by Google. So we might want to think about breaking up these larger companies to have more competition. And then we don't have to worry about any particular company doing something that is going to really have an oversized influence over our politics.
I want to get into something that you've touched on already. It's a recurring theme in your book, the decline of local media in particular, and it's how it is part of what you see as poisoning our politics. Why is local media such an important part of your story? How could we bring it back?
So we do know that local media is what is most trusted by voters for providing accurate information. And unfortunately, local newspapers have been decimated, right? They've been bought out by venture capital firms that have sold off their assets. I think the Des Moines Register, I think I read a figure that they had 100 people covering state politics. And now they have 3. I mean, just really, it's not out there. And this leaves room for fake websites, websites that purport to be providing news but are really providing propaganda. And we've seen Democrats and Republicans and even the Russian government try to create these local news sites to fill that void. And so I suggest that there are basically, a couple of models to deal with this. One is to provide subsidies, right? We've got government subsidies. But another is the donation model, right? That's kind of how public radio works. It's also how things like the Texas Tribune or the Nevada Independent work, right? These are focused on particular states, but they provide deep investigative reporting. The other thing I suggest is that journalistic groups set up codes of conduct. This is what it means to be a legitimate journalist. You get two sources before you make a claim. You try to get a response from someone that you're writing about. And then there could be a seal of approval, voluntary seal of approval that goes on media companies. And that could be used on social media so people know, oh, it's from Wisconsin Public Radio. They can be trusted because they abide by these characteristics. And I think that would be a way to give another signal to voters as to what is valuable information for them.
We'll leave it there. Rick, thanks again for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure.
That's Rick Hassin, Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine, co-director of the Fair Elections and Free Speech Center. He joined us today to talk about his latest book. It's called Cheap Speech: How Disinformation Poisons Our Politics and How to Cure It. If you have an example of disinformation you've run into maybe lately, let us know about it. Email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org.